Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Exciting. Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum.
Am I allowed to be here? I'm 44.
The age limit starts at the edge of the dais.
All right, everybody pack up. All you old people, get out.
I am Regan McMahon, former deputy book editor at the San Francisco Chronicle, a blogger for Mommy Tract and The Poop, and this evening's moderator. Tonight, we're here to examine the state of modern parenting with Inforum's program, The Secret Lives of Parents Revealed. We have two authors here tonight to discuss the intimate truths about parenting today, sharing their own experiences and perspectives, and ultimately exploring an entirely new way of thinking about kids. So let's get started. Tonight, we host Ayelet Waldman, an acclaimed novelist and author of Bad Mother, a chronicle of maternal crimes, minor calamities, and occasional moments of grace. Ayelet is known for her fearless opinions on motherhood and love. And Poe Bronson, novelist-turned-journalist, who is known for his work in the New York Times and Wired, and for his best-selling book, What Should I Do With My Life?, and most recently, Nurture Shock, New Thinking About Children. Now, let's get down to talking about all these, the new prevalence of people writing, parents writing about their own experiences being parents, which is so different from before when parents, you know, in the 50s and 60s, everything was, you know, we have endless patience and we're raising perfect children and everything's just fine and we never complain. And now there are mom blogs and there are everybody, and there are lots of books, people talking about the struggles of being parents and revealing all their own bad moments and failures and stuff. And Ayelet, personal revelations are your stock in trade, and you once said about being given your first blog, because I tend to write really honestly about myself, it was like giving a flasher a raincoat. And when you happened to write in print that you loved your husband more than your children, you were attacked in the blogosphere. So it seems like there's still taboos there, things you can and can't, things that are acceptable and not acceptable to say about, you know, parenting.
Absolutely, I certainly think they are. I mean, I do think that the profusion of mommy blogs, of daddy blogs, of confessional writing about parenthood is just part and parcel of the profusion of people writing sort of solipsistically about their own lives, you know, everywhere, on every topic. I mean, you know, what the blogosphere has given us more than anything else is a place to express our own sort of narcissistic ramblings, which, you know, as you said, are my stock in trade. So I think it's certainly true that we are seeing a lot more of it. I think there's actually been a pretty stark difference in what happened 4 years ago when I published that piece in the New York Times about that basically said in a nutshell that I loved my husband more than my four children. The outcry was so intense and so vitriolic. And, you know, I ended up having to go on Oprah to defend myself, having to, like they made me. But now when I published this book, there was much less of a hue and cry, and there was much more of a sort of amen kind of thing. And I think that there has been a shift in the last 4 years away from this notion of, you know, we can do it all, perfect parenting, to, you know, oh my God, this sucks, and, you know, why am I doing this, and I hate that woman with her perfectly frosted cupcake. So I do think there's been a at least, you know, and I like to think that I'm at least in part responsible.
Yeah, and but also, so big part of it, I think you're absolutely right, is just people are spilling their guts about everything, right? But another larger issue is this, is what you were saying, that back in the 50s and 60s, you earned credibility with your friends by maintaining appearances, by your children looked like trophy children that you could brag about at the golf club. And Now we live in an era where credibility comes sort of, it's like street cred. We're all looking for street cred, so that means confessing, you know, the worst stuff that goes on, and that's how you get credibility. Sort of we've inverted the whole paradigm, just as we've shifted from, say, conditional parenting, which is the style of the 50s and 60s, where you were only loved or given affection if you were doing what your parents thought was acceptable, and any intellectual explorations off the beaten path were shunned by your parents. And now we have this immense need to give unconditional love. And that means, you know, to unconditional love to everything that we might spill our guts about, except for the ultimate taboo, which is to love your husband more than your children. Or in my case, writing about how we talk about race or things like that. So,
you know, when in your book, you tell stories about raising your own children, seemingly in as a way to get into topics, like which I found really effective when I read your book, because, like you mentioned, the race issue, you know, where you talk about the science of new studies showing why is it that even though we have integrated high schools, kids still tend to self-segregate in racial groups and stuff, and then you talk to the researchers and found out the dynamic going on there, and when you ultimately came out with the conclusion, or the research does, that it is important that the big flaw in the system is that parents aren't talking to their kids directly about race, and then you try to do it with your own son, and you talk about that process. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, you summarized a lot of it, and so I don't want to repeat what you said, but that's exactly right. My wife and I sent our child to a very diverse preschool in the Western Addition Fillmore neighborhood. And we, this is one of the few things as parents we'd ever talked about ahead of time, was that let's do this and we don't talk about race. We just treat everybody equal and our children will grow up understanding this stuff. And we thought that that was the right thing. When we came across the science, we were revealed that that's actually kind of dangerous to do, because it leads kids to think that asking about skin color is taboo, and you're not equipping them with understanding people's ethnic and cultural identities, which helps them bridge gaps with other people. And so that was when our son was 5, and now he's 8, and he's, you know, a devoted reader of his African American biographical sports history, and he's really into pronouncing things the way people would do it in their country, and so he doesn't like us to say Mexico, you know. He wants to say Mexico. He wants to learn things that teach him how to make friends cross culturally. So we were down in Costa Rica, and he really wanted to know what were the best local Costa Rican soccer teams. So that when he met other boys, he could ask them, you know. Or here in San Francisco, he asks other, you know, Mexican American players whether they root for Chivas, or they root for Cruz Azul, they root for Club Mexico, and you know, it's his way of bridging those boundaries, and he feels comfortable doing that. But he feels comfortable because he's asked about those things, and we don't fail to talk about those things.
It's a terror, you know. One of the things you described that's so true is what a risky and feeling that is for white parents to sort of, you know, you have this notion of yourself as this multicultural hero, right? And we also send our kids to diverse schools, and we're feeling really, really good about ourselves in terms of, you know, how we talked about or how we talked about equality, right? But then, you know, we never talked about the fact that our circle of friends was not exclusively, but very definitely predominantly white. And after I read your book, I started discussing that with my kids, and I started trying to be more open and, you know, talking about skin color. And it's very, it's frightening. It's a real, you know, you really have to sort of gird your loins for that conversation, because everything inside you is screaming, oh, just don't talk about it. Just don't talk about it. We're all equal. We're all great. They won't even notice. They'll grow up race blind. When, of course, you know, they don't. And I had a really proud moment. I got this email from my kid's teacher, and they were looking at all sorts of different art today, and I guess they had some African art, and my son said, that's racist. Black people don't all look like that. And, you know, it was like, once I was really proud of him saying that, but then also it leads to discussion about, like, why African art looks like this, and what some, you know, what art from different cultures looks like, and why this, you know, art from South Africa might look like this, and different epics and all that stuff. And it's really, it was a much more interesting conversation because I'd been pushing myself in the direction directly, you know, inspired by Poe.
One of the things that you were talking about a few minutes ago was that actually just on the subject of sort of bias and, you know, racial, gender, religion bias and stuff like that. There's some new research in that that you've learned
about.
Oh,
well, we were talking earlier, and I was talking about one of the things that – there are so many things in Bad Mother that actually are duplicative or additive to what was the science that I came across, some of which is a nurture shock, some of which isn't in the book, one of which is in the book. But you had a chapter where you talk about sort of the what if your son was gay and would you have to deal with homophobia and that kind of thing. And
right.
Again, this is one of those things that maybe because we live in the Bay Area, we're insulated from. But the work by Stephen Russell at University of Arizona, who is the leading expert on this stuff, is very interesting. It shows that, first of all, kids feeling bias bullied is very common in elementary schools, middle schools, and high schools. But what's most interesting is that most of the bullying that would exist, most of the socially dominant behavior and the sort of put-downs that go on in school is bias-related. 75% of all of that is bias. So that's first category would be race, second category would be gender, third category would be religion, fourth category, this is by sort of size of the effect on how common it is would be sexual orientation. The last one would be disability, like mental or physical disability. But what's fascinating is that all the bullying programs, especially the one that the American Association of Pediatrics recently endorsed, the OLEAS program, which is a Nordic program being applied here, don't mention bias at all and never treat bias and deal with bias. And you can't deal with bullying until you deal with bias.
So what, did they just assume that bullying is some, you know, ephemeral thing that exists?
No. What it is that bullying, we all know bullying is bad, mm-hmm. right? So we call, in our society today, we call all sorts of things bullying. Bullying used to be this, like, neighborhood thug who ran around and stole your lunch money and put you in your locker. But now any sort of social taunting that goes on, any sort of antisocial behavior or social dominance is called bullying in our culture, and we want this zero tolerance thing. We write in the book about... that's problematic because most of this socially dominant behavior comes from kids who are socially busy, and they're actually, those same kids, for the most part, are very pro-social, that they're twice as nice to your kid who's as mean, but they are mean too.
Right.
And these are both tools of social dominance. Being nice and being mean achieve the same end, which is that I become more socially central, center of the group, people revere me.
Absolutely.
And so, well, we write about, but anyway, going back to the bullying programs, is that... that they don't treat bias, they don't deal with bias, and bullying isn't going to go away, and taunting isn't going to go away in schools until you give more kids these lessons about how wrong that is.
There's this really interesting thing that was going on in my son's class. So I have a 12-year-old son, and they started using this language of bias in this incredibly progressive school. I mean, this school has an entire gay rights day where all the children dress in rainbow clothing and they honor gay heroes, and it's the most gay-friendly place I've ever seen, and it was one of the reasons we chose the school. And these 12-year-old boys are calling each other faggot. Hey, faggot, you're queer. Okay, and I said to my son, well, what about the kids who have two mommies in the class? Those children, what do they do? And he said, well, I guess they just kind of, you know, they sort of smile and my God. I'm like, and I'm thinking, you know, this is an environment where these kids have been indoctrinated in empathy and in not just tolerance, but embracing gay issues. And here they're using the same language. So what's the answer in that kind of situation? What do you think would be, you know, given the research that you've been exposed to, what do you do under those circumstances?
Tell them to stop. That's old-fashioned way.
Well, that's what I did.
Smack
I said,
them.
If I ever hear you do that, if you those words ever exit your mouth,
that's wrong.
You'll never touch a computer again as long as you live.
Yeah.
But, you know... It's like what had the school's response is, you know, I think they're bringing in, you know, communicators to teach them how to positive communication.
Yeah, consultants. Yeah, bring always the problem is some expert or something. You know, but you're describing it in a way that sounds like it was what the scholars would call rough and tumble social interactions.
Right.
And the kids have to learn irony, and they have to learn to use pet terms for each other. And, you know, we can't rule irony out of kids' lives. I mean, this irony is actually well-studied from a vocal speech, and they understand when kids get it.
Right.
And they are seeing that basically because irony is and jesting and all this sort of teasing that kids don't get it and they don't understand it and they don't understand when it's meant to be friendly.
Right.
And so you have to be careful about bringing in some, say, corporate consultant to handle your school issues, but there's no doubt that saying those kinds of things hurts some people's feelings, and that's where the focus ought to be directed.
Since you're talking about social dominance strategies, one of the most interesting chapters in your book that I found was the whole issue of lying and how you talked about why kids lie and how much they lie and how nice kids lie and good kids lie, but that it's actually a strategy for, staying on top socially.
Well, that kids will... all kids will experiment with lying, but certainly by their fourth birthday, and they'll be lying in observational studies twice as often by the time they're six. But that's when they hit school, and now they can start lying to sort of gain social status. They'll say they own Pokemon cards they don't own.
Right.
They'll say they have a dog at home that they don't have. Mm-hmm. But also kids will start calling them a liar. They'll learn that you don't, and then. So it'll get socialized out of most kids, or at least half the kids. The other half of kids, if they don't get it socialized out by the time they're seven, they tend to hang on to it as an operating style for difficult circumstances. But lying for social status is just one aspect of it. Really, it's really lying to avoid punishment, and thinking that when kids lie, they're really trying to pretend for a moment to their parent, I didn't do it. Because that they think their parent doesn't want them to have done it. And if you want kids to tell the truth, it's important not to emphasize punishment, but emphasize how happy you'll be if they tell the truth. My daughter, who's five, who is quite a little tricky, little manipulative little girl, we've been doing this for the last year and a half or so, and it seems to be working, at least with us. She doesn't lie. We always prime her, right? And she's about to lie, like, I'm really happy if you tell me the truth, and she'll tell us the truth. At school, we'll see what happens.
We had this one. So I see this theme that's going to develop tonight is Poe has the actual facts and reporting, and I'm going to just tell you stories about my kids and hope that he can, analyze them and maybe solve their problems. So this is my favorite lying story. So it's first grade, and it's Parent Appreciation Day, and each of the kids wrote a story about their parents, a sort of an appreciation of their parents and all the things that they love about their parents and what their parents do with them. And there was a big brunch, and the kids, it was all they laminated them and they decorated them and they'd worked on them individually with a teacher. So, and everyone's crying, right? So every kid gets up one after the other, and then my son gets up and he reads this beautiful, beautiful, almost prose poem about how he loves his parents because his daddy taught him to play poker and sometimes let him win, and his mommy makes the best fried chicken in the world. It's super crispy, and this whole litany. And Michael and I are sitting there, our faces frozen, because not a single thing is true. Nothing. And it's not like, Michael spends hours and hours and hours of every day playing with the kids, playing Legos, playing, every game you can imagine, not poker. And I don't cook. Michael cooks. He's the cook. I have never made fried chicken in my life. I wouldn't know how to begin to make fried. So some woman leans over and says, hi, I love to get your recipe. I'm like, I don't. So we went up to... We went up to the teacher and we said, yeah, none of that was true. And she goes, no. I mean, I work individually with the children and we really brainstorm. And I said, no, not a word. And she's like, wow, never happened all my years of teaching. We have two choices here. We can go with child of writers, incredible imagination, pathological liar, needs therapy. I say we go with the first one. I was like, good plan. And I took that thing and I put it on the wall because, as you know, just testament to, I feel like it is this profound, evidence of just the lengths that child will go not to tell the truth. It's amazing.
Poe, one of the things that you bring up is in your book is, why is it that there's been this paradigm shift of the uninvolved parents of the previous generation, and now parents are super involved, but why aren't the kids nicer?
Yeah.
They're worse, right?
Well, basically, with parents like us, why can our kids be so cruel to each other? You know, why would our children, our siblings, argue and fight, you know, with parents like us, you know, who teach them sharing and kindness and compassion from the moment they can walk and talk, and you know, how to share and organize nice play groups or at school, why is this such socially dominant behavior going on? And so, well, what we cover is, to some extent, some of our solutions are backfiring, which is that, first of all, people like me who can pop open a baby crib in like 10 seconds flat and could change a diaper one-handed, or, right, you know, like your husband can, I'm sure. And, you know, that...
What you call the progressive dads.
We call the progressive
dads.
Super
progressive dads.
Yeah, and that, you know, on most dimensions, we smoke the competition, be that being traditional dads and disengaged dads. But our kids turn out to actually be a little more aggressive and act out more at school. That seems to be because we don't really discipline very consistently. And the other thing seems to be that we actually have more marital conflict at homes on average. And that seems to be because we're trying to divide up all of the caretaking and who's going to do the swifting around the house, and that leads to some arguments that otherwise, which don't even, people who just break it up, you know, old-fashioned way, don't even have to argue about.
Right. But the women just lead lives of quiet desperation.
Right. So there's these things backfiring, but largely also that these things are organic to kids. The sort of the social dominant behavior is something that's going to go on no matter how great we are as parents. And we shouldn't be surprised to see this kind of behavior going on, that it's something that has to be sorted out. The most interesting thing is about that I was reading about recently and wrote about this on Newsweek is about aggressive behavior over the course of the year. And they actually measure this in preschools, but it works all the way up through sort of elementary schools, which is in September and October, you're going to see a lot of dominant and aggressive behavior.
Interesting.
And by November, those who are socially busy, the queen bees, will have established themselves, and now they will begin to repair, and they'll use the whole rest of the year to repair. And they'll actually be really nice to everybody else around the school. And if you came in and you just looked at a school, say, in February, and you tried to spot the queen bees you, by how aggressive they were, you couldn't see them. They're actually less aggressive than non-aggressive kids. What you have to notice is how acts of aggression are reacted to differently. When a queen bee or a popular kid acts aggressively, the other kid will repair, and all the other kids will watch. When a kid who's low on the status pole... This is three-year-olds I'm talking about now. When the kids low on the status pole act aggressively, other kids basically don't watch and kind of turn away and withdraw from that kid. And so it's about how kids react to it that tells you who really, what's the totem pole in the rankings.
I think the writers of Gossip Girl are following the same formula, because that's what happens with the characters there. The really mean ones at the beginning of the season get kind of nice by the end.
I've missed the last few weeks' episodes. We got to catch up.
It is super interesting. I mean, there's this fabulous book by a woman who won a MacArthur Genius Grant, whose name I'm suddenly blanking on, but it's called You Can't Say You Can't Play. And it's she's a kindergarten teacher, Vivian. I'm terrible. I can't believe I can't remember this name. It's because I'm over 40 and shouldn't even be in this room. And her whole theory is working with kindergartners is that... that this kind of exclusionary behavior is so destructive, not just to the excluded, but also to the excluding. And she instituted this rule in her kindergarten class that said, from the very beginning, you can't say you can't play. You don't get to choose who. If someone wants to play, end of story, they play. And there was, the kids were just horror. I mean, what do you mean we can't exclude people? What do you mean I have to play with him? And the parents were also sort of stunned by this. But the most magical results that she saw were in these queen bees who were working really hard to assert a kind of dominance and who had that avenue, I'm sure they found another avenue, but had that avenue frustrated. And it really did sort of help. There was one, I heard her being interviewed, and she talked about this one girl she bumped into the mother years later. And this girl, her life had really been changed. She was a much nicer person, a much more pleasant person for having had that impulse frustrated a little bit.
Yeah, the socially dominant, the children who are oriented towards becoming socially dominant will use whatever tactic works. Mm-hmm. So if you rule out certain tactics, they'll use pro-social behavior endlessly. Right. They'll invite and have play dates and say, come over to my house and join us and all sorts of things. Because that will make them socially central. And that's what they're really after.
Is there a way to strike a balance between the kind of hard-ass former way that parents were parents to the sort of coddling way that parents, the boomer parents, became? And now I don't know where we stand with younger parents. But I do know, like someone was talking to me recently about how there's the issue of, this is actually a different topic, but the issue of younger parents have abandoned this idea that we sacrifice for our children, and it's all about, you know, to be fulfilled, I need to be a marathon runner. And so now I'm going to take up marathoning. And, you know, my kids can, you know, fend for themselves, or I'll get babysitters or something. So I think there's a little shift maybe from the sort of coddling, I have to be there every second and help you with your art project every minute. And the other is like, you know, okay, I had you, but I got things to do.
Well, I think, you know, I like I said, in the past 4 years, I really feel like I've noticed something of a transition. We used to feel like we were just the meanest parents ever. Like, everybody else was nicer than us, and we were told that daily by our children, because we had really strict rules. I mean, we're very strict parents in many ways. I mean, you can't watch TV during the week, only on weekends, with the exception of Project Runway, because, of course, come on. There's a kind of speaking to adults that's simply not tolerated. When an adult walks into the room, you stand up, you shake your hand there, you introduce yourself, you behave like a person. I really do feel like it takes a little bit of effort to be that way, to sort of have these expectations and demands. But the other side of it is just so miserable, because we've been there too. I mean, we've had periods where you know, we do that inconsistent parenting thing where, you know, we don't really know, like one day, as you describe, one day the punishment is no TV, and the next day the punishment is getting yelled at, and the third day, I just don't have the energy to fight about it anymore. And that just, you end up in this kind of lockstep of, you know, ultimately the kids just, they don't even know how to respond and how to behave. So, but it's all, you know, how many of us, I feel like I read about this in intro psychology when I was in college in 1986. You know, there was authoritarian parents and, authoritative parents, and what was the third one? Let them do whatever they want, crappy parents.
Yes, disengage.
and of course, you know, the authoritarian parents as opposed to the authoritative parents had you know, their kids behaved better. So I don't think it's any of it is really news. It's just, you know, that, you know, we have to, it's paying attention, I guess. I'm paying attention to the research.
Well, and Regan, you were asking about this feeling that you have to do all these things for your kid and you have to be there all the time. And I would be interested in what you two think about this. I mean, to some extent, I think that there are these large ideas in our society and that have long shadows. And I think a lot of our really deep guilt and consternation over these sort of work-life choices that people make was to some extent a function of the science around attachment parenting, mm-hmm. which is sort of like a trump card kind of thing. You know, it's a very powerful idea that I think is passing in its vogue to some extent. I mean, there was really good studies by the Council of Contemporary Families that show, well, you know, all these good attachment theories work really well as psychological theories. When you just measure kids who go to daycare versus kids who stay home with their mom, the kids who go to daycare don't have any less visible attachment in any measure than kids who stay home with their mom. So epidemiologically, it's not quite confirmed. And I think the extent to that sort of not as dominant in our culture right now is liberating people to feel a little less confused about these choices. Other work done by the Life Work Institute did polling of, you know, 10,000 kids, and it asked them if you could change one thing about your parents' sort of work-life issues, you know, what would it be? And they asked 6,000 of the parents to guess, and the predominant guess from almost the vast majority of parents was, my kid wants more time with me. But that was one of the lowest-ranking questions that the kids wanted. What the kids wanted was their parents to be less stressed out and frantic when they were home with them. And they also did another polling, which was not as many kids, but it was around kids whose parents had worked, moms had worked when they were growing up in the home versus moms who hadn't. And the 80% of the kids whose parents had worked thought that was, now that they were adults, they looked back and said, that was the best choice for my mom. I'm really glad that she did that. And of kids who had now grown up and their moms had stayed home, about half of them said, you know, maybe I wish my mom had taken a different path. And I think this kind of science isn't, say, right or wrong in any way. And there's no good and bad answer here. It's just more that it's alleviating some of the guilt that's going on that you write about so beautifully in your book.
I think, you know, I live in Berkeley, which is sort of Western nexus of attachment parenting theory, Park Slope, and maybe, you know, what's that? Northampton, Massachusetts, or the other two locations where you really see this kind of insane, but it really it was it's a real tyranny, and it was a real tyranny. I think it's definitely ebbing. I remember a woman being accused. The Berkeley Parents Network is an online. How many of you? It's a very popular online listserv with thousands and thousands of members. From around the Bay Area mostly, but also people who've ever tangentially been involved in Berkeley. And there's these advice panels where people ask for advice about actually quite astonishing things. My husband is cheating on me. What should I do? You know, my kid won't sleep through the night. What should I do? And a new mother posted a really heart-wrenching post about how she had... she was desperate for sleep. It had been 4 months. She was suffering like classic signs of acute sleep deprivation and really feeling like turning on her baby and just being at it was quite clear this woman was at the edge of despair or past it. And members of the listserv turned on her, and she asked about sleep training. And that she would dare to talk about sleep training her babies. And one woman accused her of practicing abandonment parenting as opposed to attachment parenting. That if you don't have your baby in bed with you, you're an abandonment parenter. And I, at that moment, I kind of blew up on the list, and I, you know, went on an anti-Dr. Sears tirade. And I really do think that Sears and his poor, long-suffering wife with the 5 children in the slings hanging from every limb of her body, you know... they really have done so incalculable damage to the lives of women. But I really do feel like I feel like I'm sensing, and thanks to, you know, people like Poe who are actually showing the research and getting the research out into the mainstream so that we can kind of overcome the, you know, we're so eager to find ways that we feel guilty. And if you're not wearing your baby and sleeping with your baby, that's a way to feel guilty. But then we have you know, an actual... you know, research that comes out that shows that, you know, guess what? My kids love me just as much as your kids love you. What a shock. And God, I'm so awful. Who would have thought?
Since you, in your book, Ayala, talk about, you know, being called a bad mother, and you really explore all those mm-hmm. kinds of things, what are the ways in which you feel that you're a good mother? Because you know, you're a very funny writer, and you very much talk in deliciously self-deprecating ways about the, you know, the way
you sound like my shrink. She's like, we're not going to use that word anymore.
Yeah.
We're just going to talk about the ways that you're a good mother. Think about it. Well, I do think that our approach to discipline has been not, you know, it's like, you know, overall, it's been a good one. I feel good about the fact that we demand things of our children and that they can be really delightful around grown-ups, which is really nice. I mean, I don't think they're always delightful around other children. I know my oldest daughter, I was so ready to be the mother of a loser, but my oldest daughter is definitely one of these queen bees. So much so that when she went to sleepover camp when she was, I think, six for the first time. That's how independent she is. And I remember running after the bus as it took her off for 5 days at Camp Tawanga, screaming, "Be nice to the fat girls!" So, you know, the way that they have that kind of, they understand that when, you know, that how they're supposed to behave, I think that, I feel really good about that. I feel really, on the other side of it, I feel good about... and this is just, you know, because of my own complicated psychodrama with my mother, I feel good that my children really know that I'm on their side. So when they do need an advocate, I have 2 kids who have fairly mild but, you know, noticeable learning disabilities, and that they know that, you know, I'm going to be there pushing for them 1,000% of the time. But now my older son is, you know, he's of an age where he now has to assume the responsibility for advocating for himself. And so I'm I was just congratulating myself on the way over here that I've been letting him have more space to do that so that I'm not the one calling the teacher and saying he needs more time on the test. If he feels, and he doesn't always, but if he feels he needs more time on the test, it's now he's, you know, assuming the responsibility for that. So that.
How about you, Poe? What are you doing right
now? No, I'm not falling into this trap. What ways am I a good parent? What ways am I a bad parent?
Well, you can tell us the ways you're a bad one.
No. I think that this is, you know, I think the whole good-bad dichotomy, which we both write about in both books and is implicit in your title, and you write about it from the front cover, and to me it's something I come to at the end of the book, which we call the fallacy, the good-bad dichotomy, is that when you start dividing things into good and bad, the minute you do that, you separate from what the science says. The science says all sorts of things are they have good dimensions and bad dimensions of them. They have interesting effects in children's lives, and the tendency to categorize, and this pervasive need to label things as good or bad for kids, all it does is it serves the internet comment culture because neither side is true, and it perpetuates both sides. You can argue endlessly because nothing is ever good or bad, so the argument never ends.
Right.
You know, we were writing last week about peer pressure, and it's really interesting. You know, peer pressure is a thing that we think is sort of this evil in young teenagers' lives. Joe Allen is one of the best friendship researchers there is in the country, and he's done this long-term study of kids from when they were in seventh grade, and he's followed them now for 12 years. It's a very good, diverse sample. And, of course, he's a clinical psychologist. He was worried about how much peer pressure they felt, and so he had 19 different constructs to measure peer pressure on them in seventh grade. And he followed them over time. What was interesting is the kids who felt more peer pressure in seventh grade, sure, in the short term, led to a little bit earlier sexual activity, a little more alcohol use, a little more drug use. But in the long term, now they're graduating from college and stuff, they're turning out better, way better, a little bit better GPAs. But what's interesting is they have much better relationship quality with their romantic partners, with their friends, and with their parents. So why would that be? That's sort of wild.
So like, fascinating.
Well, what's interesting is if you think about what is the teen brain, you know, in seventh grade, the higher density of oxytocin receptors in the amygdala causes kids to have this sense that everybody's watching them, the imaginary audience. They just become socially attuned, and they feel like every little nuance around them is something they pick up on, and they feel like, ooh, that person just judged me because they moved their lip a tiny bit. But if you think of what kind of friend you want to have in your grown-up life, you want someone who pays attention to your moods and is willing to negotiate and compromise with you. And so the same things that led to feeling more peer pressure in seventh grade led to, ultimately down the road, kids who are way more socially attuned, willing to negotiate and compromise in their romantic relationships, their friends, and their parents. So you can say, oh, peer pressure is bad for you, but actually it's through the forces of peer pressure that kids, and peer comparison, that kids who care a lot about what other people think, they care what society thinks, they care what their parents think, they want to, you know, get good grades and go to good schools, and they generally, it was kids who didn't feel peer pressure back in seventh grade. What was distinct about them over time was actually a lower GPA, way lower. And they were just sort of like, you know, average students who didn't excel. And it was because they didn't care what anybody thought. They were disengaged.
And think of the money being spent right now in every single school in the country, on resisting peer pressure.
Right.
I mean, it's so fascinating. No, you're right. I mean, the whole reason I wrote this book was because that word, that bad mother language, had so toxified, if that's even a word, my experience of mothering that I wanted to just, you know, explode it and say, enough of this, enough of calling one another bad mother, enough of, you know, this constant circle of judgment that we're in. You know, I mean, the fact is that everybody does it a little differently. And what works for you, works for you, works for me, works for me. And, you know, the only obligation any of us has is to just do our best, you know, and hope that some portion of the time that's good enough.
What about this trendy term, emotional intelligence, developing emotional intelligence? Is it a good thing to show your kids your frustrations, one's frustrations at home? Since, you know, I mean, it's one thing to blog on a mommy blog about, you know, how tough it is to be a parent, and it's another thing to fall apart in front of your kids because you've had a really trying day. I mean, is it okay to cry in front of your parents, Paul?
Kids. In front of your kids?
Well, my only issue there is that you're calling it emotional intelligence, that somehow that's grooming your child's emotional intelligence when, you know, there's every bit of science to say, you know, to not bottle up your feelings in front of your kids. Because when you do that, you're being insincere. And the other side of it is a lot of sham anger that parents do. They act more outraged than they really mm-hmm. are because they're trying to deliver a message, or they act really upset, or they act really happy. All these sham emotions that parents put on, kids see through, and there's a lot of science to say that they see through that insincerity, same as they see through insincere praise, or same as we see through insincere compliments. And so, you know, we can't call our kids smart and then pretend that we're pulling one over on them when we tell them all these things. And so, yeah, being emotionally sincere with your kids is maybe a little bit different than being brutally honest all the time with your kids. There's an appropriate level of disclosure for children, for sure.
One of the things I love that you talked about was this idea of children viewing conflict between their parents, of not taking it upstairs and closing the door, but rather they sense the conflict. That's their whole job in life is to spend all their time looking at you and figuring out how you feel. You know, I mean, they do that whenever they're home, and that they get the conflict. But what's better for them is to have them witness both the conflict and the resolution, because then you model for them the behavior of how to resolve, how to make up, how to, you know, resolve conflict.
Well, that was one of the eerie things about, because you have a whole chapter on that.
Yeah, I know.
Book,
it's so strange.
Where you come
to
decide,
confluence.
You know, I'm going to let them hear the conflict through the wall, but I'm going to hear them let us make up as well. And that was exactly what the science says.
I do have to say, I had a couple of moments like that of reading Nurture Shock, which I gobbled up in a single. I got the Kindle. I hate to say this, where their book sells around, because I couldn't wait for it to come on Amazon. But then I went and bought a whole stack. But the ways that it was like, look, there's research to support what I'm doing. Yeah. And then every once in a while thinking, oh, damn, okay, we'll fix that. Yeah. The sleep thing, I don't want us to close with that. I think one of the most important things you talk about is the sleep issue. I think that's profoundly important. I think you should give us that riff so that all of these people can go home and force their high schools to start an hour later.
All right. Well, so we unwittingly have stolen an hour of sleep from our children's lives in the last 30 years. And it's hard for us to know this, because when we have our kids today, we look back at our own lives and we think, we didn't get a lot of sleep. And you're not getting a lot of sleep. You know, that's what it's like. Life's tough sometimes. And what we didn't know is that when you actually measure it out, take what you got and subtract an hour, and that's what kids today are getting. And this goes all the way down through elementary school. Even kindergartners are getting a half hour less sleep than they did 30 years ago. And we could get by on this when we didn't know what the cost was. But just to give you a couple examples, work by Ave Sade at a Tel Aviv university had kids, fourth graders and sixth graders, get 1.5 hour less sleep for 3 nights in a row. And he gave them, an IQ test before and after. And the sixth graders were testing like fourth graders after 3 nights of just a half hour less sleep. Every half hour counts. On average, this is data out of Minnesota and Rhode Island, A students in high school average 15 more minutes sleep than B students, who average 15 more minutes sleep than C students. Now, that can't generalize to any one kid, but it does suggest these sort of deep cognitive deficits, and it's what's happening is that in your sleep, genes upregulate that help encode memories. And you've heard of stages of sleep. Well, each stage is actually used to sort of recode what happened that day and put it into long-term memory. And kids spend 40% of the night in slow-wave sleep. Grown-ups spend only 4%. So we're not as affected by this as kids are. And what comes down to all of it is saving money on buses. That we used to have two fleets of buses. One took the elementary school kids, one took the high school kids. And to save money, we started sending high school kids to school at 7:40 in the morning, 7:20, 7:30, so we could have one fleet of buses. And they're showing up at class at a time of day when melatonin is still squirting in their brain, trying to get them to fall back asleep, and they can't cognitively perform.
You know, it's interesting when...
Can I interrupt you for one moment? We're going to be taking your questions soon, so if people would like to start lining up at the mic. We'll keep talking for a few more minutes, but if people, once we start the questioning, you guys can, you'll be there.
I, you know, inspired by, I had read this piece first, I guess, in Newsweek when you guys had the sleep, was that where you
published? New York Magazine.
New York Magazine. So, and I had, you know, basically sent it to everybody I knew. And inspired by that, I asked at my daughter's high school. My daughter goes to Lick Wilmerding High School here in San Francisco. And she, because she commutes from Berkeley, she has to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to get to school. So we told her that she could only go to this high school that she wanted to go to if she was willing to go to sleep at 9:30 every night. And she had been going to sleep at 10:30, so she was going to get an hour less sleep, and she was going to have to wake up an hour earlier, she was going to have to go to bed an hour later. But the adolescent body does not want to go to sleep at 9:30. It's really been a struggle for her, and involves, you know, chamomile tea and L-tryptophan and all these things to kind of re-regulate that. And when I asked the school about starting an hour later, they had actually, I think probably inspired by the research that you looked at or even the article, had an exploratory committee that looked into this. And what I was told, whether or not this is accurate, I was told that the reason they determined that they shouldn't start at 9 or 9:30, a time that would be so much better for the teenagers and would actually maximize their academic performance, was because of athletics. Because if they went, they would have to go to school until, say, 4 o'clock or 4:30, and then the children wouldn't be able to participate in the athletic programs, you know, with other teams. And it seemed to me this, you know, as someone who is, like, decidedly not jockey and has all sorts of opinions about that, it was just this horrific irony that here, this is really, really doing this, that, you know, we're going to actually, in an academic institution, give up on absolute, clear, scientifically proven academic benefit for what? For lacrosse? So, yeah. So, you know, I really do think there has to be, like, a mass movement to change
right. Well,
this.
What you're saying is there need to be more system-wide things.
Exactly.
For the schools that go that compete against Lick Wilmerding all need to.
Yeah, everyone has
to
do it
together.
We need
to have our games at 4:30 or at 5 rather than 3:30. You have to kind of do it together.
Exactly. I mean, knowing that the kids are, you know, you can't, none of this stuff can change. You mean, a single school can't make the change, but a system can. So, hopefully, you know. I'm lucky I have a lot of children, so I can screw up the first couple. Maybe by the time the little ones are in high school, you'll have inspired a revolution that will have changed the time, and I won't have to get up until 9 o'clock to drive my kids to school.
I will still need to defend for a moment athletics.
Know you would.
Just a little thumbs up for those. I think that kids really like it, you know, and we need to develop their bodies too. So.
Okay, well... we are going to move on to questions now. And as a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's In Forum. And tonight we are hosting The Secret Lives of Parents Revealed. I'm Regan McMahon, former deputy book editor at the San Francisco Chronicle and author of Revolution in the Bleachers and moderator for the evening, in discussion with Ayelet Waldman, author of Bad Mother, and Poe Bronson, author of Nurture Shock. Now let's go get to our first question.
Hello. Thank you for speaking. One thing, I work with kids a lot, and I've noticed that sometimes when they're using words like faggot, or in some cases that's racist, I note that one of the difficulties is that sometimes... they're not really thinking of the term. They're thinking of the term as a demeaning term, not specifically of a because that's the behavior that's going on. They're
not linking the term to the bias.
No, exactly.
They're expressing it in terms of bias, but they're not linking it to bias.
I was wondering if you had any thoughts about that.
Yeah, well, it doesn't matter how the person is saying it, what they mean. What matters is what the person hearing it feels. I mean, and I think everybody in the room knows that difference. And that's what kids have to be sensitized to. They have to learn its broader constructs of theory of mind, recognizing empathy and how your actions and your words are perceived and felt by others. And, you know, that goes back to the whole peer pressure thing. I mean, that kids who are socially attuned can feel these things in the minds of others, even though their faces might be trying to hide it, and or even to your kids and at home, and that they can feel their emotional Geiger counters to what's going on between mom and dad. And so I think it's helping kids understand perspective taking, what it's like from other people's point of view.
Okay, is there another question from the audience? Here comes one.
Okay. So thanks a lot. This has been really interesting. And I sort of have partly a personal question and partly wanting to hear a little more about some of the material in your book, Poe. I heard you on a radio show. I haven't read the book because I haven't had a lot of time, unfortunately. You talk a lot about the importance of failure and also the importance of limiting and being specific in praise. And I wanted to hear if you can say a little more about that. And that's something that I've tried to employ in my own parenting with minimal, with some success, but not as much as I'd like. And I have a six-year-old who has a desire to be perfect in everything that he does. And so we're struggling with trying to get him to be satisfied with things that are not perfect and to minimize his frustration. So,
yeah, well, so the science of praise, I mean, this goes back to, I think, the notion that, you know, oh, we can never be conditional lovers. We have to be unconditional lovers. And therefore, we kind of got confused by the self-esteem moment to think that kids need more than unconditional love. They need constant and lavish praise showered on them at all times. And so the science would say to, rather than giving your kids this global constructs of how great they're doing or how smart they are, what kids want is they actually want to succeed at these things. And their attention ought to be directed to the strategies that very specifically help them do well. And so, you know, for the soccer team I coach, to me that's, you know, don't go straight up the field, go sideways to the sidelines where there's lots of open space, and just trying to train children to inhibit the impulse, just like animalistic impulse, to crash into other people straight ahead and to cognitively be aware of other attentional cue, which is there's a lot of green grass over there. To my daughter, who's five, who's doing her early reading and her phonics books. And to her, you know, I it's not about how good you're doing or bad you're doing. It's not how great you are. It's we're going to do this a little bit every day. By the time you're seven or eight, your brain's going to wire, the front of your brain's going to wire up to the back of your brain, and the white matter tracts are going to sync up, and then you'll be reading like great. And in the meantime, it's putting in the time. And so her, I direct her focus to keeping her eyes on the page rather than looking at me every word to see if she got it right. I direct her attention to keeping her finger moving at a steady pace underneath the lines. I direct her focus to making the initial consonant-consonant or consonant-vowel sound as a pair, so she gets the start of the sound coming out. And if she focuses on just those three things, she's reading. And if she is thinking about how good she is as a reader, she's looking at me, she's ignoring everything, she's throwing a tantrum because she's being asked to read a book that she's never done before. Kids want to do well. Give them the tools to achieve that and stop trying to just pretend or lie to them that they're doing well at all times. Kids just aren't fooled by that.
Ayala, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
You know, it's interesting. We were just having a discussion earlier. One of my younger daughter has mild dyslexia. And feels terrible about her academic performance, and it comes home and cries about how she's not smart. And I've really it's what I really want to do is just say you're smart. I promise you're smart. But you know she knows that what smart means in third grade is reading really well and doing the math pages quickly, and she can't do that. It's a constant battle for me between wanting to make her feel better and knowing what's going to make her feel better. So talking about like the things, and I hope that I'm doing this right, but I'm talking about the things that she does well. So I say, you know, right now she has beautiful penmanship, and I say, you know, everybody has these skills, and you catch up, and look, you have beautiful handwriting, and there are other kids whose handwriting isn't as good, and so, you know, that's an area where you excel. It's taking you longer to figure out this reading thing. You have a glitch in your brain, and your brain has to, you know, work around the glitch, and eventually you'll read like all these other people, but it's, you know, when she's crying, I don't want the glitch, I'm stupid, you know, you want to just stab yourself in the heart with an ice pick. It's horrible. It's a really hard feeling.
Well, but even in that sense, I mean, dyslexia is a pretty broad construct.
Right.
Its simple definition is a child is cognitively capable of far more than would be represented by their ability to read or decode text. So to know dyslexia, it means you actually have to test a kid's cognitive abilities. So they're doing various types of reasoning tests with children. And so you can give your daughter other things that make her feel good. You could play like the game Chocolates and Perfection. And there's tons of, I'll give you some names of these tomorrow.
Oh,
I'll send them to you by email. But there's things that she can do that don't demand decoding text.
Right.
Be that numerals or words, but that are actually very cognitive challenging that would demonstrate to her she's got great fluid reasoning.
Right, exactly.
And that's what being smart really is. Mm-hmm. In the short term, decoding text is, you know, as Malcolm Gladwell said, you know, people don't go to, you know, Nobel Prize aren't awarded just for being a good reader, you know.
Oh, but what if they were? I'd have a stack of them on my desk.
So, shall we do our next question?
Sure, thank you. Thank you so much for this. This is really amazing. There's so many things that, while you were both talking, that I want to say, oh, yeah, I totally agree. The thing that struck me the most and prompted my question is I was heartened to hear you both kind of trashing some of the conventional writing on parenting, and particularly Dr. Sears and some of the other books. And the question I had when I was first pregnant and all through the last 6 years of parenting is, do these writers think that women just lose complete control of their senses, like their faculties are just gone once they become pregnant? I remember a stack of books I got when I first became pregnant and, you know, about nutrition. I thought, oh, I'm going to eat more kale. And one of the books I opened up had, and I'm not kidding, it had a no-no list. And that's what it was called. And I thought to myself,
I know that book. Let's just be honest.
Right?
What to eat when you're expecting. Terrible.
It's like, am I the baby here, right?
Yeah.
So what I thought through all of this and have sort of, through the parenting, have really tried to get to the science and to some of the original texts, but I wondered if either one of you had thought about sort of just the gender implications of all of this compartmentalizing and all of this, the dichotomy of the good, bad mother, and the gender implications specifically, sort of just the infantilizing of women through this whole process.
I mean, I absolutely do. I mean, I think about a lot of this in terms of, you know, traditional feminist theory. I mean, I think the notion of the mommy wars and the good mother versus the bad mother is just the same game that we've been playing forever. And I don't think that it's an accident, for example, that, and, you know, I might sound like a conspiracy theorist here, but one of the ways that one of the reasons we're being pulled so dramatically as parents is because in order to be an effective employee nowadays, you don't work 9 to 5 anymore. When I was a little girl, the train pulled into the station at 6:04 from New York City. I grew up in New Jersey, and all the daddies got off the train. You know, all the professional daddies, the blue collar daddies, they worked one shift. All the daddies got off the train. Now that 6:04 train pulls into Ridgewood, New Jersey. There isn't a living soul on it, because if you're not there till 8 o'clock, you're not doing your job. And it is rather interesting that just at the moment when women enter the workforce in great numbers, particularly the professional workforce, suddenly the expectations of employees, you know, expanded dramatically. And I think that does have something to do with the reaction of, you know, the sort of implication of women's empowerment. And I do think that this kind of language we engage in, and it's complicated, right? Because who's calling, who's saying you're a bad mother? It's usually not the guy around the corner, because frankly, they don't really care. It's, you know, we're the authors of our own subjugation, women primarily. But I think it is part of that sort of a larger, more complex narrative. I mean, I think there's a reason. Dr. Sears in particular, I find really enraging, because I think it is a patriarchal Christian approach to parenting that does try to say to women, you have only one job, and that job is to be physically available to your child 24 hours a day. So, you know, I find it incredibly oppressive. And particularly when you see the research, you know, all those Scandinavian children, all of whom go to daycare, they're fine, turns out. Go figure.
Yeah, I mean, just, you talk about the infantilizing of the audience, you know, from the typical, say, parenting manual type of book. We started what we were doing, Ashley and I, with New York Magazine, because they have a very sophisticated readership. But even then, we were writing about, at that point, the science of praise. You know, we fought editorially with our three editors at great length over how much science we could put into the piece. And we dug our heels and we fought, and my editor, my agent helped me, you know, through these battles that we were having. And finally, the magazine said, maybe you're right. Just geek out. It'll be different, you know. And it became the most emailed article in the magazine's history. So I think that what we were trying to prove was that you can trust readers' intelligence way more, way, way more than anyone had thought you could before, and that they wouldn't be turned off by hearing the methodology of the study and hearing about the population group and who does it, how far can you generalize it. And we hope to sort of set a bar for how you could how much you could present and how much people could take, and then maybe that would bring a lot of these other, you know, very popular books along with presenting far more science behind what they're saying. And not just science, but the quality of the word. We're both, you know, novelists as well, and so there's something you bring to the page and the way you tell a story that is, I think, is equally important, that is about trusting the reader's intelligence.
If you guys, you know, given sort of the changes in raising kids that you're talking about, have you thought at all about what those adults would look like in, say, 10 years or 20 years? Like, how would you, if you're going to tell stories about, you know, what the generation that's 5 or 10 right now, if you were to apply a lot of the stuff in your book, both your books, what would be said about those generations in, say, 20 years? How would they be described differently than, you know, folks that are in their 20s right now?
Well, I have a very strong feeling about this, which is that the dual narratives of generations always persist. That the stories, so today's generation, Generation Y, these facts are all true. You could say that, you know, they graduate from college, but, you know, a huge portion have to take remedial class because they're not actually ready when they get out of college. And that there's this tick back up in teen pregnancy, and, you know, these kids are twittering and they've got all these these electronic gadgets. They have short attention spans, and they look really terrible by all these measures. You could also say of them that AP scores are really high. More kids are taking AP tests. More kids are graduate. College population is doubled. More kids are applying to more colleges. Yes, they have to take remedial classes, but it's less than it was in 1980. Volunteerism is an all-time high. And basically, kids today are way too driven and way too focused on their success. Both narratives exist in our society because we need them to reflect at what we have at any one time. So I predict that the same would be true of the generation of kids that grow up today. You will see one day in the New York Times how kids today, or, you know, the young generation that's graduated from college is amotivated and distracted, and then you'll see another story about how they're too driven. And that's how we'll always tell the story of generations, and it's the way we always have. As to how they'll actually be, that's sort of just speculation.
Can we get in one more question before we have to close?
Thank you. this is very helpful and interesting, considering my husband and I are just starting our family. A question for you. One of the things I observed in the 70s is that every adult that we interacted with was a Mr. or a Mrs. or an aunt or an uncle. People had titles. And now all the adults are just known by their first names, including in a lot of places, teachers. So do you think that there's a correlation between that and the amount of respect that children give to adults?
My older kids went to a school that the teachers were called Mr. and Mrs. And at the end of the day, or Mr. and Ms. And at the end of the day, they had to shake their teacher's hand before they were dismissed. I liked that formality. Now they go to a school where everybody is on first name basis. I think there are shifting ways. You know, every society has its own notions of, you know, proper respect. And I think that there are there's certain times when it's appropriate, and it's only appropriate, to use those signifiers. And there are other times when, you know, we have more flexibility. I think what's most important is that you teach that children model the behavior that's appropriate to the culture in which they're participating, and that can change from moment to moment.
Yeah, the little bit of science on this does look exactly zeroed on it again, intuitively, without any science behind you. But you got it right, which is what's important to kids is actually to be able to transition between such worlds, that they recognize when they're in a situation when they're supposed to be using Mr. and Mrs., and they recognize when they're in a situation when they're not supposed to, and that they can naturally intuit that and do that. And so it's less about enforcing always one or always the other, but then reading the appropriateness of the circumstance. So if a school, now hopefully if a kid is in a school where they don't say Mr. and Mrs., in our school they do, that they will still learn that there are circumstances where you would say right. Mr. this or Mrs. that, miss that.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's give a big hand to Ayelet and Poe for their thoughts here tonight. Now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.